if I I can actually figure out how many of each denomination we'd need to have as a function of that temperature, and I have actually done this. Yes, I am a bit sad. I did it in collaboration with a former student called Martin Salem. And in the two universes, this one's got a lot more coppers in it. This one's got a lot more silver and a lot more of these shopping trolley tokens. After a few outreach visits by schools, I realised I'd better not put real pound coins in, so we just have the plastic tokens now. How do I know that this is the distribution of coins? Well, that comes back to this simulation. Okay, so this, I told you this was the biggest cluster of galaxy in their simulation, but it's just one of absolutely thousands. This is just a tiny zoom in to part of their simulation. So there's the big monster cluster, but all of these little pink things are clusters. And what we do in cosmology is we start a universe running inside a computer simulation knowing in advance what the parameters are, and we can figure out how many of the big ones there are in relationship to the smaller ones. And that allows me to predict how many coins would be in the box. And in fact, this is fairly accurate. It was based on Leon's predictions of what we'd do in the dark energy survey, because in fact, of the pennies are very much more common in the universe than the other coins. In fact, you'd probably need 100 pennies to find 120 pence. But they're so small, they're like my baby Russian doll, that we can't see them. So in fact, we don't find so many of them in the dark energy survey. And it tells us what type of universe we live in. But I haven't told you what dark energy is. So this is why I wanted Charlotte to come down and to count my pom-poms. Can we have the lights back up, please, Matt? All right, so here we have some more boxes. So Charlotte, can you confirm, you can tip them all out, then in each box, there's the same number of orange ones as green ones. Right, the green ones being the dark matter, there should be five times of those compared to every orange one. Now, that's the very early universe, and there's also a tiny little black one, right? Okay, go to the next one. So this is maybe a billion years later. Look at that. We've got the same number of star stuff, we got the same number of dark matter, but now we've got two black ones. Keep going. So about 6 billion years after the start of the universe, we've got the same number of dark matter, we got the same number of star particles, but there's now as many of the black ones as the rest of them put together. All right, go for the next box. So the next box is now. And by now, there's, for every one dark matter particle, there's two of the black ones. Now, the black ones are the dark energy. Right, get the next book. So that's now. What's going to happen in future? You think you'll have to take it in front of the table, Charlotte? Right. And take that top off.
You have to pick them all up.
No, don't empty it. There should be... All right, there's one orange one. There are the green ones. I make sure that if you did take them all out, you would find green ones. Thank you very much, Charlotte. So that's what could happen in the future. Is that as the universe is getting bigger, there's more and more of the black stuff. And there's not any more of the green stuff and the orange stuff. And this comes back to the boxes. Why I care. Because this funky box here, what's going to be the next one? Great big moving truck. The more universe you have, the more dark energy you have. It's like a builder paying you to make an extension, and the bigger your expansion, the more they pay you. Now, for Bob and I have just been through a very expensive building project, obviously that's not going to happen. So ultimately, this dark energy, it's forcing the universe to get bigger and bigger, faster and faster. And eventually the universe will, it doesn't rip itself apart, but what it does rip apart are all the particles. So the clusters of galaxies will start peeling apart. The galaxies will start, you know, distributing themselves, not in the center, but towards the outside. And the same thing keeps happening as time goes on. Ultimately, you'd even have planets ripped out of the solar system, and you can even have atoms ripped out of molecules. So the reason I care is because that could happen very quickly. There are estimates that this might happen in like 50 billion years, and who cares? Maybe we'll even have Brexit by then. But it doesn't have to. It could actually happen like this. The whole thing could just go. You wouldn't know beforehand, and you certainly wouldn't know afterwards once all of your particles have been pulled out of your body. So if you take away nothing from this lecture, just live life for every second, because it may be your last. Yes? Yep.
Is energy being created?
Yeah.
So we're actually talking, so this is a...
It's like the magic porridge pot.
Yeah, okay, fine. Because normally in a system you'd expect energy overall to be equal.
Yeah, but it's absolutely bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers. It goes against everything that we were taught, you know, as physics students. It doesn't happen. You can't just generate energy just because you've got a bigger vacuum. It doesn't make any sense. This is why so much money and so many people are working on this, because we're hoping it's not true. So we're going to wrap up very soon. So what have we learned? The expansion rate of the universe slowed. The universe was still expanding, but the rate was slowing down for 6 billion years. And then for the last 8 billion years, it's been speeding up. Now, we've observed this. We know it's happening. We just don't know why. In the future, the universe may rip itself apart. And if we want to know whether that catastrophic conclusion is what's going to happen, we need to know the ratio of the dark matter to the dark energy. So as we went through our boxes, we went through very little dark matter to the same amount of very little dark energy to the same amount of dark energy and dark matter to where we are today, when we have for every one dark matter particle, two dark energy things in terms of mass. And the great thing about clusters is they're sensitive both to the rate at which the universe expands. And you can imagine that. If you think about those filaments again, it's hard for stuff to flow down a filament when the universe is expanding very quickly. And they're also sensitive to the density of the dark matter, how much dark matter there is, how much fuel there is for us to make the clusters in the first place. Now, why I'm still doing this after 27 years is because we need very, very sensitive telescopes to be able to find the clusters, especially as you're looking at the ones that are far away at the point where you're transitioning from a decelerating universe to an accelerating universe. And telescopes in space, they are very, very expensive. We also need supercomputers, and I think that has probably been the most fundamental change in the field of astronomy, is the fact that we can now model the whole universe to try and figure out what's going on. So that's why it's taken me so long. And then I'm supposed to go to my conclusion slide, which is all the way back here. But look, you can enjoy all of these lovely pictures that I took in my office yesterday. Where was it? And there's Jedward. Was that it? Huh? Anybody see the conclusion slide, please? No. Ah, there it is. Yay! All right, so what have I been doing for the last 27 years? I've been trying to find all the clusters of galaxies in the observable universe. Haven't found them all yet. It's possible with the new telescope called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope that is being built very close to the Ceratololo telescope on the neighboring mountain, and should have take its first data in 2 years, that we will have found all of the clusters of the observable universe. How have I been doing that? I've been doing that in space using X-rays, on the ground using optical, and then at the South Pole using microwave radiation. And why do I bother? And why haven't I finished yet? Well, I bother because I really want to know what's going to happen with all those black pom-poms. I actually have more bags than my office. I have spent, sorry, Vice Chancellor, about £30 on black pom-poms. And the reason it's taken so long is because we're having to wait for the old technology and the computers to catch up. And that, everyone, is me finished at 7:30 exactly. Oh, nobody told me that.
Secondly, to don't insult your parents. And the third is that we ask, thanks, I'm delighted to ask this question.
That was Oscars.
Oh, I didn't win.
You did win. Thank you very much, Kath. Thank you, Vice Chancellor. It's just so proud for me to be here. It's very humbling as well to close tonight's inaugural lecture. It's a testament not just to Kath's ability as a scientist and her reputation and her achievements, but just her enthusiasm that so many of you are here tonight, the friends, family, who I have seen for the first time, and Kath and Bob's children I've seen grow up, colleagues, obviously from the university. I've travelled down from Liverpool, but I know people have travelled from even further afield. Both Bob and Kath's family here. So that's really, really, really great to see. So what Kath's demonstrated is you know, these clusters of galaxies are great laboratories for us astronomers to do science with. And that's really been the backbone of Kath's successful career, is using these clusters as laboratories to study some of the most important questions in the subject. I first met Kath, I remember her walking into the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. It was 1991, and I spoke to her, and she said she was in Manchester then doing an undergraduate, and she wanted to do a PhD, and she said she'd done a project on elliptical galaxies. And I thought, yeah, that's close enough. And the rest is history. So she became my PhD student from that time on. The first paper that Kath wrote 3 years later in 1994 was a Nature paper that was published in Nature. That's very rare to get a paper within a reputable and high impact journal like Nature. And then Adam's spoken a little bit about the statistics. They speak for themselves in terms of a publication record. More than 120 papers in peer-reviewed journals, but also with very high citations. The average citation, that's the number of times other astronomers reference your work, cite your work in their papers. Typically in astronomy, that's a few, roughly. Well, in Kath's case, publications are referenced an average of more than 30 times. And for those in the field, that gives her an H index, I won't go into that, of over 40. And that's very, very good. That's excellent for someone in her relatively early stage, I would say, of her career. There's some big impact papers there. The work that she hasn't mentioned at all, but the work on the Bright Shark survey from the ROSAT satellite was one of the very first meaningful samples of clusters in the X-rays to be published, and it's still very highly cited, and it's still one of the seminal pieces of work in the field. And she's continued that, facilitating new research in clusters through her work on the starting with the Bright Shark survey, the X-ray cluster survey using the XMM satellite, and more recently her work with the dark energy survey. And she's a very able astronomer. She's very dedicated. She's inspirational to young researchers, to PhD students. You've just seen the space that she's given over to making sure that her students are recognised in the work that she does. She's a champion of equality and diversity, and is both stimulating and fun to work with. So I certainly am very proud to be our ex-supervisor, and also the ex-supervisor of Bob Nicol. And I consider myself not just as a colleague who's still collaborating with both of those, but also a lifelong friend. I visited them several times in the years to make sure they were okay. When they were in Chicago and Pittsburgh at Northwestern and Carnegie Mellon. We went on many observing trips together in different places throughout the world. And now you want me to answer the question about CTIO. I think it's to do with the car, isn't it? Yes, yes. So we went to CTIO, as Kathy showed pictures of the Blanco telescope there. But in the other direction, there's a big car park. And I was at one of the telescopes. It was Cass' first observing trip. And I got a call from Kath, quite a frantic call, saying she'd crashed the car. And when I got to the car park, the car was teetering on the wall. But as is always the case with these in such situations, only a small car, or Volkswagen. Kath, I think, was pretty much unhurt. He may have had a slight bruising. But they repaired the car and all was well. But we managed to, you know, there's so many stories I could tell of our, you know, of some of the observing trips. We got lost in the war. You remember this, don't you? We finished our observing run at the Anglo-Australian Telescope, and nearby is a national park called the Warren Bungles National Park. It's a big forest. And we went walking one afternoon, and it got darker and darker. And then we lost our way, and we ended up in the middle of this forest at night time in the middle of Australia, which, and I can assure you, there's a few very frightening things that you have to look out for. Then I think we had a torch that ran out of, ran its battery down, if I remember. So that was interesting, and you know, that end also right to the other end, really. I remember in South Africa we went to a restaurant together, and this restaurant was so posh that although we were given the same menu, Kath and myself, her menu didn't have any prices on, whereas mine did. So if there's anyone from the funding agencies here, they'll probably go back in the records and look at the reconciliation for that trip and realise it was a little bit expensive. But anyway, but I think there's a number of obviously academics in the audience, and I think. I think they'd empathise with the fact that one of the best parts of being an academic as you progress in your career is seeing young PhD students, people who you've mentored, people who rely upon you for your supervision and your guidance in their professional lives, see them become mature scientists in their own right. And I'm proud of both Bob and Kath that they've managed to do that there. Obviously a husband and wife team with wonderful children, but they're both professors, and they're both professors in the same subject area. And I don't know any other team that's achieved that, to be honest. Professors in different subjects, but it's rare to be a professor in similar disciplines. And as I mentioned earlier, they're both really in the prime of their careers, and I think it's a case of the best is yet to come. So I think it just leaves me to thank the University of Sussex, to thank Adam, to thank the events team here for putting on this event, and to thank Kath for just, you know, a marvellous inspirational seminar and talk this evening, and hope you all have a safe trip home. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
All right,
you don't have to go yet. There is a reception outside, and I have to say, by special request, it's beer as well as wine.